Hey, you've joined us for This Week in Law. And next up, we've got Ayaz Akhtar, Greg Sandoval, and Evan Brown to go shark hunting for both Lawyers in the Courtroom and Groove Shark. We're going to talk about Mega Upload, Pinterest, and lots more next on Twill.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twill, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, episode 158, recorded April 20th, 2012. Name it after a beer. This episode of This Week in Law is brought to you by Netflix. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on your PC, Mac, iPad, iPhone, or TV instantly, all streamed directly to you, saving you time, money, and hassle. For your free 30-day trial, go to netflix.com/twit. Hi, folks. It's Denise Howell, and you've joined us for This Week in Law. I'm really excited because we've got a fantastic panel this week. We've got Greg Sandoval joining us from CNET. Hello, Greg.
How you guys doing?
Doing well. It's great to have you back.
Thank you for having me.
Our pleasure. Also joining us from the Twit studio is Ayaz Akhtar. Hi, Ayaz.
How are you guys doing? It's nice to be back on Twill. And do what I love about Twill? The chat room during Twill. Very, very reasonable people. I really do love
them. Yes. We love them too. And they're always feeding us great information and questions. So thank you, chat room. It's great to see you all too. And back after a couple of weeks hiatus is Evan Brown. Hello, Evan.
Hey, Denise, how's it going? It's great to be back. Yeah, like we were talking earlier, it was 3 weeks ago today, last time on the show. So I feel like out of practice, rusty at the, you know, at the skill of making this stuff up as we go along. So I'm happy to be back in the fray of it and looking forward to our conversation.
Good. We'll try to make it up for you if you should be having any difficulties with that.
That's good. I need all the help I can get.
Well, I'm not quite sure what to start with because we've got a lot to talk about this week, all really interesting, so it doesn't really matter where we start. Let's start with Walmart. I think it's fascinating that Walmart is charging folks money who bring in their DVDs to be able to access those DVDs, the whatever's on the DVDs, in the cloud. In other words, Walmart is getting into the lockering business and charging people a fee to do it. Folks seem to be pretty excited about this, going in and forking over their $2 or $5 to have access to high-definition video content. Now, this is all part of Ultraviolet and Vudu, which have been out there sort of limping along for a while. But now they've got Walmart in the fold as sort of their distribution arm, I guess, leveraging off of all of their customers. And I could see where people would be excited to do this. The implementation of it is a little cumbersome. You have to have both a Vudu and an Ultraviolet account, and you have to schlep your DVDs into Walmart, and then they're going to stamp them on the inner ring of the DVD that lets Walmart know, yes, this one, in fact, has been used to show that the person has brought their DVD in and is accessing this stuff. I guess it's a protection against the same DVD coming in over and over and over again for several people. All of this is reminding me a little bit about of something that happened a really long time ago now with MP3.com, where they wanted to have the notion of you would put your DVD, or back then it was your music disc, in your computer, and then you would have access to that CD in the cloud. And MP3.com got sued out of existence for just such a strategy. But now, apparently, with everyone on board, it's a different world. Greg, have you followed this at all? Do you think this is interesting?
Very closely, and I do, because you know what this is, right? This is the death throes of the DVD, of the movie disc. This is the final chapter. And what the studios, the six top Hollywood studios, are trying to do here is make one last desperate stand to generate interest in this format. Because we all know now, right? We're in tech. We all know now it's easier to get your movies via Netflix, via Vudu, via, which is Walmart's own online distribution, via Hulu. So what they're doing is they're trying to sex up the DVD And they're giving you, you know, for people that are interested in making this transition to, they're trying to tie this digital to this older format, discs. You buy, you bring in your disc and we'll give you access to the internet, internet distribution. But it's really just a way for them to keep you interested in DVDs.
Yeah, that's a really interesting take on it. I hadn't thought about it that way before. It gives your DVDs, you know, that may have just been sitting around gathering dust, some value all of a sudden. You have a way to enjoy them in a format that your DVD player can't provide. Ayaz, are you going to take your collection into Walmart?
You know, I've seriously thought about it. Now, I'm a geek, so I will constantly rip my own stuff, and I know that I'm probably breaking all kinds of laws when I do that. But of course, they're not copy protected. But anyway, the thing is, there's some kind of nicety to this concept where if you bought a Blu-ray nowadays, you get a digital copy, you can go ahead and have a very standardized version of that movie. Taking your old DVDs back when they didn't have this option and charging you $5 to get the HD version, I think that's actually a nice little thing. The other thing is, you don't have to bother to upload your stuff to the cloud or run your own server at home. So even the Ultraviolet's had a bit of some stumbling blocks in its initial launch. The thing is, you can access your stuff on the cloud, and you don't have to bother to keep it for yourself. You can download it if you want. There's a whole lot of flexibility that if you have enough DVDs and you don't want to spend the time to go ahead and rip them yourself and then theoretically run afoul of the law all the time with the DMCA, it seems like it's okay. Whether I'm going to do it or not, I don't know yet, because I don't know if I want to grab all my DVDs. I've seen some lousy stories about this where some people went to Walmart, tried this, and the person at Walmart couldn't sign into his own Vudu account to set it up. So It's about the actual implementation. If Walmart employees are educated enough to the point where they can make this easy and simple, I might go ahead and do it.
Hey, can I say something, Denise, here? We are really tough. I think the public is very tough on the studios, right? So they're trying this Ultraviolet, this format, which is really just a bunch of specs and design so that services can come in and cloud services can offer movies online. And everybody wants it, you know, perfect right off the bat. But it's going to be, you know, this would be a version one. They should have called it a beta one for this kind of thing. There's going to be some bumps and some ugly parts going out in the beginning. But I think the real substance here of the problem is, and the stuff that I keep hearing from my readers, is that they don't want to pay for a movie again. They've already paid for the DVD. They think that they should get it free. And, you know, they have a point. If you pay for it, why do they have to pay again to access this?
Back to the mp3.com idea. You put it in, you show you owned it, you bought it once, and then you have access.
Good friend Michael Robertson. That's right.
Right.
See, I can see that argument for like the $2 SD version if you were actually getting it at the same resolution as the DVD. But the thing is, there is a cloud storage element. So instead of like actually paying monthly for somebody to serve your video or to give yourself access to your own server, you're getting that theoretically for free, right? Or you're paying the $2 for it. But the $5 upgrade for me, I'm like, I like the idea of taking my old DVDs. I wouldn't buy them on Blu-ray again because I already have them. And 720 by 480 isn't so bad. But to upgrade that to 1080p, or it's, I don't actually know if it's going to be 1080p video or not, because who knows how the stream is going to look. But it, I can see why people are annoyed by it, but $5 is cheaper than buying the movie at full price at 15 extra bucks.
Oh, the studios would love you, they would say. But let's face it, the tech audience has gotten used to getting free content.
Oh, yeah.
And so anytime they're asked to pay for something, there's a lot of griping about it. And you know what? They've become accustomed to it. And the big question, though, is how long are they going to allow you to get access to this locker for free, right? So that's kind of underlying there. People are wondering, okay, so they're going to charge me to scan my DVD and put it in the cloud, but do I get this cloud service perpetually free, or is there going to be a charge later on down the road? And that hasn't really been answered yet.
That's a horrible thing to think about. I didn't even contemplate that idea. I figured you paid for it and you get to have access to it. But you make a good point. Because if they lose the rights, that's the other thing. If they lose the rights in the contracts negotiations in the long run, like maybe my Warner Brothers movies disappear. Or maybe my Universal movies disappear. I didn't think of that. Good point.
Right.
And then they also have control of it, right? Then you're upset. They've got you locked in there, too. Mm-hmm. That's just been one of the complaints.
The other thing customers probably aren't thinking of is how their data usage plans are going to accommodate all this. If they move their movie collections into the cloud in HD format and start streaming all this as their primary way of viewing, you know, is their cable bill going to accommodate that? Is their iPad data plan going to accommodate that? Seems like an interesting little wrinkle that Walmart certainly isn't addressing. Evan, do you have any thoughts about this? I'm also interested, too, in the stamp. The fact that your DVDs are now branded seems like it has some implication on the first sale doctrine if you were going to try and resell these things.
Yeah, well, my understanding is that the DVDs would still work, so you could still use them, you know, as a DVD. You just couldn't use them once again to avail yourself of the cloud, you know, copy of it, so that available for streaming. So, you know, that may have some the fact that they're stamped may have some impact on the value that they would have in the resale market, but it would only go to that aspect of it and not to, you know, its utility, as far as I understand it. I guess the two things that I see most interesting about this are, one, you know, the very elementary idea that this really is revolutionary thinking, if you want to, you know, come at it from a certain perspective of the movie studios, to recognize this as a means by which consumers legitimately want to consume content, and recognizing that there at least is a partial right to get at least somewhat of a discount for access to that content by virtue of having bought a DVD. That in of itself really seems to be like a mental change on the part of the studios to recognize rights that may have, been acquired through a one purchase to kind of transfer into another purchase, because conceivably you're getting it as a discount, I guess. The other kind of intriguing issue with this here is the information that can be gathered by the about the user through the Vudu platform, because, you know, the studios, you know, the platforms, third party people who are keeping track of metrics and whatever else, you know, aren't able to ascertain how often you watch a movie, or, you know, when you watch it or something like that. So there seems to be a real value that the platform is going to get here from making this content available for streaming. Because it's in the cloud, because the channels through which it's going to be distributed is subject to information gathering, there has to be something, certainly some privacy implications there, perhaps, or certainly, you know, the whole idea of what's the responsibility of the platform when it comes to the data and information that it's collecting about the collection of movies that people have and how they choose to consume that collection after it's been added to the service. So those are a couple of points that I see that are intriguing about this scenario.
Evan, there's at least three good stories that I can pluck from what you just said. I never even thought about some of those issues. Privacy, they can look at what you're watching, right? That's being addressed in Capitol Hill. Netflix wants to roll back that law. What is it, from the 80s, because of some... what was it, a Supreme Court nomination? I think it was Bork.
Yes.
They looked at his video library, what he was watching, that kind of thing. They could,
right.
Conceivably, someone can take a look at what you're seeing, and nobody wants that, right? So that's one of the things that hadn't even occurred to me.
Right. What is that? The Video Privacy Act?
Yes.
Video Privacy Protection Act of 1988. So,
that's
yeah.
And did you come up with that without the IRC's help? I'm really impressed.
I did, but not without Google's help.
Ah, yeah, there you go.
Yeah. All right. Well, since we're talking about lockering, let's talk about the flip side of this, a lockering service that the movie industry is not so very wild about, Mega Upload, and the saga of Carpathia Hosting. That's the most interesting part of what's going on right now, as far as I'm concerned. The hosting company, imagine yourself, you're Carpathia Hosting. You have this wonderful client who is storing just terabyte after terabyte of data on your servers and paying away and just doing exactly what you want a hosting client to do. And then they get prosecuted by the United States government and stop paying their bills. And you have all their data, and everyone wants it. That's what Carpathia is in the position of right now. And the court is trying to tell poor Carpathia what to do. Greg, you've been writing about this. Do I have this essentially right?
Yes, and I was in court last week when a federal judge, Liam O'Grady, sat and listened to arguments from the Electronic Frontier Foundation, the six major Hollywood film studios, Carpathia, Mega Upload's lawyers. Everybody is pulling at this data. And here's the good news. Liam O'Grady seems like a very smart judge to me. He was knowledgeable about the technology. He understood, you know, what servers can do and can't do. And if you're pulling for mega upload, he seemed to be a little dismissive of the government's arguments. The government was saying, hey, look, Judge, Carpathia is really not a victim here. They knew what mega upload is up to. They knew that this was going to come eventually. They'd gotten subpoenas from us. They'd gotten subpoenas from civil actions. You know, there were people suing mega upload. And now they're saying, oh, wow, this is too expensive for us to maintain this data. So don't feel sorry for them, Judge. And Liam O'Grady wasn't having it. He told Carpathia, I sympathize with you. And I think that's a good sign for mega upload and for at least the data. He did not give any indication that he wanted to get rid of or delete this information, because that's one thing that users have to know that's on the table, that if they can't figure out what to do with this, they're going to essentially, at least that's what he indicated, if they can't come to some good conclusion or response to this data, to have resolution, I should say, it looks likely that people aren't going to get their data back. It was in Mega Upload's terms of service that they had every right to, you know, to shut this off, to not return the data. And the studios are pushing hard. They're saying most of the data is copyrighted movies, copyrighted TV shows, all of it. You know, they're saying 90% of it was pirated. And so that if they can't figure out a way to like sift through and give the legal stuff, separate it from legal, from illegal, then they should kill it all. But users should know that they have a judge that's overlooking this case, overseeing the case, that doesn't want to do that.
Right. It's interesting to see the impact that cloud services and our expectation that everything's going to be available in the cloud, including our storage devices and services, has come along and really changed the landscape since the days of Napster. I mean, how much would the film industry have loved to be able to look at everybody's hard drive who was participating in Napster and see exactly what was being shared there, now that they have that kind of an opportunity in this mega upload case. Evan, do you have any thoughts or comments about this?
Well, other than to just underscore the important role that the host plays in this, and he can really be put in a rough position. And I would, if I was, you know, counseling a hosting company who was in that situation, I would say, look, the larger picture here is just what is the right thing to do in the interest of your users, even if it's going to come at a certain cost to you to preserve information and all of this stuff. The negative side of being uncooperative and either letting the information go away or to turn over too much information to the government and, you know, being too cooperative, the negative side of that is going to outweigh any benefit you have in, you know, any business efficiencies you're going to gain by just getting rid of the data or something like that. So I guess the other point that I would make is, as Titus pointed out in the IRC, that it was the Carpathia that came and rescued the survivors of the Titanic. So that's no small irony in all of this discussion. And it's very timely with the recent centennial of the sinking and all that stuff. So
isn't this a colorful story? Here.
That's right. That's right. They were kind of the means by which it sank, and also, you know, coming and rescuing it as well. So it's a multifaceted story, that's for sure.
Right. But nobody came to the Carpathia and said they were responsible for the Titanic sinking. I think that's pretty interesting that the movie industry is actually saber-rattling against Carpathia and saying, gee, you know, you should have known that this kind of nefarious activity was going on and you're complicit with mega upload. That has some pretty broad ramifications in this era of cloud storage and services, don't you think, Greg?
Yes, and the U.S. attorney kind of dropped the bomb there. He was talking to the judge and trying to, as he was showing, that Carpathia was, he was suggesting that Carpathia had lots of knowledge and the links between the Carpathia, the host, and Mega Upload, he was tying them together closer than anybody has in the past. And he essentially said that Carpathia is going to get sued in a civil suit, or the possibility exists. No one has brought that up. And he didn't outline what kind of case could be made. I wrote in my story that, you know, they can't even, it's not even clear whether the government has a case against Mega Upload, but going after Carpathia just seems like a huge undertaking, and they would have to have lots and lots of evidence to show that, right? You tell me, Denise. Seems like the DMCA was made, tailor-made for companies like Carpathia.
Yeah, it seems to me too. They would have to have some nice big old smoky smoking guns, like the kind that we saw in the Grokster case that the Supreme Court decided in 1995. So if they have that kind of thing, you know, I don't believe that they've had the opportunity to do that kind of discovery yet. So I wonder what they're basing this on, but we'll just have to see. Ayaz, what do you think about all this?
I just kind of wish that they had either Carpathia or .com was free right now, because I miss all the crazy stories about this. Right now it's very procedural, and we're trying to find out what exactly is going on with the hosting and not. But it was the insanity of the co-founder of Mega Upload that I really found interesting about this story. But like, this is going to be very cut and dry, and it's just going to be very procedural. So I'm just hoping that some madness breaks out. That's all.
Oh, it's bound to.
Yes.
At some point. Well, since we're talking about the liability of folks who deal with other people's data, of course, hosting companies are one example of that, and so are ISPs. And the ISPs seem to have completely capitulated. You know, they're definitely working with Hollywood and want to protect themselves from the kind of suits that are being threatened against Carpathia. Greg, you've been writing about this and the graduated response program that's going to go into effect. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, this is a deal that's been years in the making, right? Hollywood, the music industry, have gone to the ISPs and says, you guys are the gatekeepers to the internet. Help us stop piracy. You guys can turn off the spigot when you want to. And the ISPs have been saying, wait a minute, no way. We don't want to alienate our audience, our subscribers, just to protect your content. That's not what we are. We're not copyright cops. Then the copyright owners have gone to the government. They've gone to the president and to members of Congress that are sympathetic. And they put a lot of pressure on the top ISPs in the country. Finally, these guys have said, all right, we'll do it to a certain extent. In France, there's a law, the Hadopi, and I'm probably mispronouncing that. I'm sorry, I don't speak French, but where the government is actually mandating their ISPs to three strikes. You give people three chances to violate copyright law, and then they're off, or there's some kind of suspension of service. There's nothing like that here. The ISPs are going to say, all right, we're going to send them warning after warning and just send a paper trail. And some of the ISP says, we're never, ever going to terminate service. Others have said suspension of service is on the table. And I think that could be a big legal issue, right? How can you turn off my service based on just a claim by some entertainment company?
Back to the
Yeah, and I'm a little concerned that there's going to be some sort of assumption that affirmative claims don't even have to be made, that ISPs as gatekeepers should be watching the traffic and there should be red flags that go up based on your amount of usage, and that it's not so much a, you know, oh, we suspect this user is a troublemaker, that it's really going to be put on the ISPs to make those sorts of judgment calls. And, you know, as more and more traffic starts flowing over their networks, like we were talking about with Walmart and the digitization in a legitimate and authorized way of all this digital movie content, you know, how are they going to make these calls? Evan, does this raise a concern for you at all?
Let's say it again, because I kind of lost track of where you were going with that. Could you give it to me again?
I just think it's a big response. I think that they are being put in a maybe untenable position, that Hollywood is expecting them to police piracy, you know, for lack of a more palatable word, police
right.
The unauthorized use of Hollywood's copyrighted materials in a way where, you know, just like with YouTube, they've had to go beyond just the notice and takedown procedure and start taking affirmative steps that identify questionable content that may be actionable on an infringement basis. I'm worried that ISPs are going to be put in that situation too, and that their ability to address it is going to be even more difficult to implement than, say, Google and YouTube have had.
Yeah, thanks for helping me out when I got caught not listening there.
Okay.
I mean, how many times have we, you know, had to deal with this issue of what's the appropriate responsibility to put either on the intermediary or the conduit or whatever here? So, you know, we shouldn't be surprised at all that the studios would take the position that the responsibility lies with someone other than them as the content owners on all this. And, you know, it's even more difficult for somebody in the position of the ISP to take responsibility for this because the it's harder to ascertain actually what's going on through the system, whereas a platform like YouTube or something like that at least knows what is there, even if it's an ungodly amount of content, an ungodly amount of data that they'd have to sort through. I mean, I've lost track now of what the statistic is of how many hours of footage are uploaded to YouTube, for example, every minute here. So, you know, we can't lose sight of the fundamental idea that there's got to be some moderation in putting the responsibility in the right place for who's responsible for policing all these content. And it seems like the ISPs should be last on the list of ones to really have to take step up and take a big role in all this. So I share the same concern that you do in this.
Right. And they're between a rock and a hard place too. We were talking about privacy and people's strong interest in being able to consume things, you know, with some modicum of not being monitored by the entire world. So they've got Hollywood on one side, and I'm sure they've got privacy and consumer advocates on the other saying, hey, you know, if you're going to monitor our traffic and tie my porn watching habits to my account, then, you know, I've got some real issues with that. Ayaz, what do you think?
Yeah, to Greg's point about the French laws that were theoretically going to cut off your internet if you were caught pirating. I mean, the thing is, it hasn't stopped piracy or anything. It's not like there's been a huge decline in that country due to these tough laws. So even if you have this a government-mandated system for this, that doesn't necessarily stop the actual problem. On top of that, I'm just kind of curious about what you guys think of privatizing this versus having a bunch of laws covering it. Because I know, like, for things like the video game industry, when they were afraid of being policed by the government, they decided to come up with the ESRB, come up with their own rating system so they can kind of police themselves. And with this whole system with the ISPs and Hollywood, there is like an advisory committee that includes Gigi Sohn, who has been really outspoken about things like SOPA and PIPA. So I'm hoping that in this kind of private system, maybe it's more flexible than a government system, because government stuff can move really, really slowly. I mean, but it's, at least it's open versus this private version. But the private version may be more flexible to maybe to the market concerns, because if a bunch of people are getting kicked off of Comcast for some reason and they move over to AT&T, that's really going to affect the policies of these ISPs in general, because the consumers can actually have a chance to change something. This isn't necessarily like cable television. I mean, even though a lot of these ISPs are in that same kind of thing, which also has me concerned about how, okay, they want these ISPs are also cable companies. They want to make good deals with these Hollywood companies to have content on VOD and on-demand stuff like that. And they have to police stuff at the same time. There's so many concerns I have about this. But I still think the private version may be more flexible than a government solution.
Can I just add another thing?
Go ahead.
Yeah. Nobody, I haven't heard anybody say who wants to move this to the government. Not the copyright owners, not the music industry, film industry, nobody. The ISPs, and this is what I've heard from my sources at the studios and the labels, they're really worried about the ISPs just picking up and running, because the government isn't there to kind of, you know, push them along any longer. There's only so far and so much the government can do to push the ISPs. At the end of the day, if Comcast and AT&T don't want to do this, they don't have to do this. And all the copyright owners are worried that they'll just say, that's enough. If there's too much pushback from customers, if they end up in court and they're spending too much money on lawyers, look for this thing to collapse in a big way. It's so fragile right now. The copyright owners, there's a lot of them out there who don't have a lot of faith in it, that it's going to last very long. I just want to correct one thing too. There has been a study though of the law that was the Hadapi law in France, and there was a decline in piracy. We don't know how long that'll last. We don't know what alternatives people will find, but it definitely scared people into stopping. Now, the difference is that was a law that was government enforced. That was three strikes. This is going to be, you know, nobody wants to say whether it's six strikes or five strikes, but you get plenty of chances before you even come close to suspension. And there's no termination of service. So this is definitely is toothless, much more toothless than the French law. We don't know how that's going to be. But my point is that this thing, you know, if EFF and everybody says that, you know, it's just not working and it's not fair, look for this thing to come down.
Greg, do you know what is going to trigger having an account put under scrutiny and start receiving graduated response messages?
Yes. They're not looking into your... Yeah, they're not looking into your what you're streaming, right? So if you went to a service like Mega Upload, this would have nothing to do with that. This is purely for BitTorrent and file sharing services, right? They track your IP address, you're in a swarm. Or, this has nothing to do with that. So you get it's going to differ, too. The copyright owners created, you know, the graduated response, which has so many options. You can start – it typically starts with sending letters, right? Hey, you've been tracked. You've been accused of downloading illegally this movie or this song. The next time you do it, they'll send you another warning letter saying, hey, you've done this twice now. These are the potential problems that you could have. On the third or fourth, you might get a warning from your ISP saying, we're going to start throttling your internet traffic. And then some of the hardline companies will say, okay, this has been your fifth or sixth time. We're now going to suspend you. We're going to turn you off your internet access until you contact us, until we get a chance to talk to you. And then it could get worse. They could say, all right, you're suspended for a certain amount of time. They give them lots of options, but it was all sourced by the entertainment companies. They're the ones who are doing the tracking, the IP addresses. They're the ones who are making the allegation. There's no court involved. There's no due process.
Got it. All right. Well, I want to go shark hunting in just a moment here, but before we do that, we're going to thank our sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law, which is Netflix. Now, I'm sure you probably already know this, but in case you don't or you have friends and family who don't, you should let them know that Netflix streams thousands of TV episodes and movies directly to you instantly. This saves you time, money, and hassle. And there are so many different ways to access these streaming movies and TV shows from Netflix. You can watch on your TV, your Mac or your PC or your iPad, your iPhone and some Android phones too. In order to get Netflix on your TV, there are any number of really convenient ways. All the gaming consoles pretty much do it. The Xbox 360, the PS3, the Nintendo Wii. If you're not a gamer, there are all kinds of other options. Most DVD players are coming with this baked in now. If you buy a new Blu-ray player, Roku boxes are great. I live with that day in and day out. One of my son's friends was saying how they want to grow up and marry Netflix. They're so excited about what they're able to access there. And as a parent, I can tell you it's great because you don't have to worry about the commercials, which I always try and fast forward or avoid as much as possible so that I don't have my kid constantly exposed to all of that commercialism. And you can watch everything instantly using any of these services and devices. You can begin watching a movie or show on one device and then finish on a different one. However you choose to access Netflix, you can watch as many movies and TV shows as you want, anytime you want, and you can cancel at any time. So go try it today, 30 days for free at netflix.com/twit. Be sure and use that URL when you sign up, netflix.com/twit. That lets them know that we sent you their way. We really appreciate it if you'll do that. And we greatly appreciate Netflix's support of This Week in Law. All right, Greg. So as long as we're on the topic of folks that are irking Hollywood, let's talk about Groove Shark. What's going on there? We haven't paid attention to this company in a while here on This Week in Law, so I think you need to bring us up to speed.
The great shark hunt of the top four record labels. They've got this service, Groove Shark, which is a music sharing service. They allow people to upload their own songs and share them with the community. And the Groove Shark is now being sued by all four of them. They had one licensed deal with EMI, and EMI now has filed suit, not just for copyright violations, but they are accusing Groove Shark of not paying their bills. So this is kind of like, you know, adding insult to injury. This is a service that feels like it's parked in the safe harbor of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. And they say that they pull down stuff as soon as they get a takedown notice, that they boot people off. I've met with them. They're confident that they can take on the music industry. Other people I've talked to, you know, they're becoming, I sense though, when you talk to other people in the music industry, on the digital side, not in the music from the labels, that they're becoming kind of isolated. And they're based out of Gainesville, Florida. And people are starting to look at them and saying, hey, you've got to make some kind of deals. That it's just, you can't offer free music without, eventually you're going to have to come and license music. So I think they're in a tough situation. I really believe, though, they've been talking to Michael Robertson, right, who's the evangelist of holding the line on the DMCA. And they feel like they can carry this all the way through.
So the idea here is Grooveshark and its users are trying to argue, is it sort of a Sony Betamax kind of situation, that they have enough non-infringing uses that the infringing stuff just sort of comes along for the ride and it's not the main purpose of Grooveshark, and they're taking it down when they're notified of it? Is that the stance they're taking?
Exactly. That there's lots of songs on there that are bands and acts, right, that are unsigned, that are uploading. You know, they keep pointing to the bands that they have been discovered, you know, developed followings via the site. And, you know, the accusations, though, from the copyright owners are that as soon as they send a takedown notice, the song is right back up. A new file is uploaded. We've heard that lots of times, right? At YouTube, at lots of different services. They're saying that it's a bad faith effort by Grooveshark, that there's no way to win, that the DMCA was absolutely intended to balance the copyright owner's needs with the service. And if they can't, if a takedown notice is stripped of any meaning, then what good is it? So they've even accused Grooveshark of uploading stuff themselves. They say they have emails and documentation that show that Grooveshark are the ones, which I think would not be, right, DMCA protected, that it would be a direct, if it's proven to be in that, direct copyright infringement.
Yeah, that sails right out of the harbor. I asked, what do you think of this? Do they have a prayer?
You know, I'm kind of curious. Maybe this is a, like maybe a positioning thing. If you go to Grooveshark, it says right on the front page, discover your new favorite artist. Now, the thing is, you can upload stuff to almost anywhere. YouTube was about sharing you, right? That was the concept with the name. So they would always say that, look, you should be uploading your own videos. Don't do copyrighted stuff or copyrighted stuff. I say that so many times and wrong. But SoundCloud does a similar thing. You can upload all kinds of things and share that if you want to. But they're very specific. Again, share your sounds. So I just wonder if Grooveshark didn't just say, and actually in the title, in the actual in the tab, it says listen to free music. It's like maybe if they didn't position themselves so, I guess like this, so upfront saying you can listen to music as much as you want for free, maybe they wouldn't be in so much trouble. Because the thing is, you don't think about going to Grooveshark to find out like indie bands or putting up your own music or your own podcast or anything. You would do that with SoundCloud. And I just wonder if that was a bit of like a marketing error for them, because it just makes it look like, well, I can get all the free music I want here and I don't have to pay. So I think that's part of their problem. They have a real huge image problem.
Yeah, it's a marketing problem that could be very damning for them in court, a la the Grokster case. Right, Evan?
Yeah, I mean, where do you draw this line, though? You know, the Grokster case says you're liable for inducing infringement if your device is made and distributed, you know, marketed with the object of getting other people to infringe. I mean, that's all well and good from an academic standpoint, but how do you start plugging facts into that to really give it some meaning? You know, do you look at just the heading of the website, the header, the, you know, whatever it says there? I mean, I would think that there's, you know, it's gray at best. I guess we do get some guidance from what the court has said in the ISO Hunt case, you know, like we're structuring the website to, you know, find, you know, that site, you know, was to find torrents, like, you know, top 25 movies and things like that, where it's just, there's no other explanation for that to be there other than to help somebody find content that is obviously infringing, where it's just like ultra red flags letting the provider know that there's infringement going on here. So, I mean, it's just so, amorphous, how to do this analysis, what it really means to be promoting a site or a service in a way that is really trying to get people to infringe. It's not great the way that GrooveShark has marketed it, but who's to say that that's what will take it over the edge and make it liable for the infringement of its users, which, you know, obviously is happening. That Denise, infringement is obviously happening.
Denise, yes, and Evan, I have a quick question. When you talk to the labels and the studios, the catchphrase now, or the word that they keep mentioning, is they want everybody to have a filtering system that is like YouTube's, right? There's technology now that can track songs and video and pull it down and prevent it from getting uploaded on the site. They want a lot of these services to start utilizing this kind of filtering technology. But my reading of the DMCA, there's nothing in there about having this kind of preventative measure. Correct me if I'm wrong. And my second question was, now that YouTube has kind of had, you know, the Court of Appeals has kind of sent YouTube, Viacom back, what does that mean to these services? Because you talk to all of these services, and the first thing they pull out is, well, we're like YouTube, or YouTube is protecting us. How is this going to affect these services now going forward?
I can take that, Evan.
Well, I mean, I'd like to talk about the question of filters. I mean, you're right. There's nothing in the DMCA that says thou shalt filter or, you know, even do anything really to evaluate what kind of content is being stored on the system. Where I think that that comes in, and Denise, correct me if I'm wrong, or anyone else, chime in, where the question of the filtering should be a good idea is in making sure that the provider of the platform is doing everything it can to terminate the accounts of repeat infringers, you know, because how are you going to be able to know what kind of infringement is going on more than one time unless you're doing something to track that? And a very effective way of doing that is through the use of these filters. So to me, that seems almost like a backdoor way of trying to get that requirement in, which obviously is a benefit to the copyright owner. But who has to pay for that in terms of development and implementation and all that? It's the platform provider. So it is a bit, you know, if we were to read in an obligation to put a content filter on the service, that is antithetical to the fundamental principle behind the DMCA, which is to remove the online service provider from the equation as much as practically possible in the copyright infringement analysis, so that the onus is more on the copyright owner to do the policing and just send these notices, which presumably are supposed to be easy to generate, easy to read, easy to determine whether they're valid under 512C3, and to make a quick decision one way or the other whether to take content down. So it's you can see why the labels would want it to make that important, and it's not directly called for in the act, so there has to be a little bit of gymnastics going on to get that in there. And honestly, I forget what your other question is, so I'll bounce it to Denise to answer it.
Gymnastics too. Well, I think you hit the nail on the head, Evan, that, you know, you have to figure out under the DMCA where the balance is between the onus on the copyright owner to police and the onus on the site owner to police, you know, repeat infringers and to respond to red flags. And courts get confused on this because, as you say, the act is not terribly clear about how it's supposed to shake out in a practical matter. So we see, you know, the district court hold one thing in the YouTube case and the Court of Appeals undo some of that and send it back. And I think, you know, it's all just kind of open season, and we're going to have to see how it shakes out. Ayaz, any thoughts?
Yeah, I'm just thinking about, like, since it's so gray, it would definitely help if they had a filtering system. I understand that it costs money to do that, but I mean, if YouTube was trying, when YouTube was trying to do this and trying to become legitimate, they're like, look, we have our systems in place. You might think that we make it really easy to upload copyrighted content, but we have systems in place. So that way, they can position themselves differently. Another way, because it's so vague, you have to come up with some kind of, I mean, if you want to say, I don't want to use this word, but ascertainable standard. You need some kind of standard. And if you have a filtering system and that's gotten other people off before and it's gotten, it's removed liability, then it's definitely in the interest of someone like GrooveShark or any other sharing site to have this kind of system in place, because it worked for the other guys. Now, granted, it's not stated that you have to do that, but it would definitely show a lot more good faith. And that kind of thing yeah, that really works in courts. Like, look, we've been trying to do this. We've been filtering. We remove stuff with notices. If people keep doing this and this is how they use our system, you know, we're going to work with deals or something. They have to basically keep showing. I know it seems like everyone's the bad guy until they're saying, look, we've done everything we possibly could. And if GrooveShark wants to stand a chance, they have to, I guess, look like a good actor.
Hey, Denise.
Yes.
Do you remember, this is changing the subject just a little bit. Do you remember, it may have been a year or so ago, Kiwi Kamara filed that lawsuit against Scribd over the use of filters. I think it was either Scribd or DocStock that the platform used to tell whether there was any infringing content going up there, because as part of that filtering process, they actually had to make a copy of the work. And so there was that suit that was alleging infringement over that intermediate copy. Did you remember whatever became of that? Or is that something we should check the status on? Because that was really kind of cockamamie.
Yeah, it was dropped. The suit was dropped. I'm reading David Kravitz in Wired. And it was in Texas. It was Scribd.
That's the first time I had thought of that since, you know, that lawsuit was filed, because we knew it was kind of silly when it happened. It just kind of is a illustrative example of how no good deed goes unpunished. An act that was, you know, intended to help ferret out infringement, you know, being called out as an act of infringement in and of itself. So perhaps there is no winning when it comes to filtering content.
Right. The lawyers didn't say anything too enlightening about the suit being dropped, just that Scribd's attorneys came out and said they realized that Scribd has very strong protection under the law.
That's very lawyerly of them.
Yes, it was. Well, let's since we're talking about sharks, let's talk about some of the best sharks, most well-known sharks in the lawyerly sense. Have been battling it out with each other, with their clients as well, some of the best known folks in the technology industry, as Larry Ellison and Larry Page go to court in the Oracle versus Google case. They're bringing along their lawyers, including David Boies and Robert Van Est, who are both, you know, it doesn't get too much more heavy hitter than right there.
It's fancy.
Yes, very fancy. And they are starting to plug away at the Oracle versus Google case. And, you know, we're talking about GrooveShark and the things they should do and trying to make themselves look good, or anybody who's in the situation of maybe winding up in court over their actions. You definitely want to have a good paper trail, and you want to have documented, you know, what it was that you did to anticipate these problems. And the comedy of the Oracle versus Google case is the amount of smoking guns they're coming up with, and the amount of people on the stand saying, gee, I just don't recall. And, you know, the classic instance of deposition testimony being pulled out and contradicting what people are saying on the stand. Seems pretty classic litigation scenario, and nobody seems to be coming off like a real rose in this case at this point. It's pretty early on in the game. They just started putting witnesses on, what was it, Tuesday or Wednesday of this week?
Yeah.
So lots to watch there. Greg, have you been watching this trial at all?
A little bit. You know, you get fascinated when you see somebody like Larry Ellison in court, right? And he's in there testifying along with the Google guys. So it is amazing, though, also to see them kind of field questions, right? It harkens back to, like, Watergate and all of those White House officials saying they couldn't recall. And these are some of the smartest people we have in the country, and all of a sudden there's, like, gaps in their memory. So it's interesting. But like you said, it's just started, and we haven't seen the whole story yet. But help me with that, you guys. When somebody says something like that, what is the impact? Does that have other studies done? Do juries really look at that guy and say, he's not being sincere, or he's trying to hide something? Does that hurt you worse than trying to just answer honestly? Or whatever the worst thing you could say is, yes, I wrote that email. Is that worse? Because I look at that and I say, oh, he's being evasive.
Who knows what juries think?
I think there is a good amount of bad will that goes along with having too many I don't recalls, or gee, it was so long ago, in the position of a top executive at a huge company like the ones involved in this case. You know, there is some degree of, well, these guys have other things to worry about than the day-to-day mundane details. But this is a pretty key issue, how they're going to put together this piece of software that's going to be so pivotal to the future of the company. And, you know, the fact that they, I think everybody admits, and they were in negotiations to try and license Java, and those negotiations fell out, and later on we have this suit. So it doesn't look terribly great for Google at the outset. Just, you know, kind of smacks of, gee, you guys forged ahead anyway. But it's going to come down to, you know, what they knew about what was being included. I think that there is at least some assertion in the case that, hey, we didn't use anything that wasn't absolutely fine and open source and didn't need a license at all. But right. That should be fairly easy to iron out in the case. Ayaz, are you guys following this on Tech News today?
Oh, yeah. We're following this a lot. Mm-hmm. And it's getting... I mean, the thing is, every development that happens, we always go to the same conclusion. We have to find out what the judge thinks, if APIs are copyrightable at the end of the day. Because most of the patents that Oracle is trying to use to say that that Google copied their stuff or whatever it was, the five of them were invalidated and two of them were left. And it seems like Oracle's really hanging their hat on their copyright issue here. And, like, I remember trying to wrap my head around how exactly could Google get in trouble for using an open source piece of software on their own. And I had to, like, sit there and write out, like, notes to figure out. This is, like, back to, like, law school days with pencil and paper, figuring out exactly how this case works. It just seems like nobody's got a really good argument here. I mean, Nilay Patel was talking about this on TNT. He's like, this is the battle of the weakest arguments you've ever seen. And and the fact is, the copyright issue is it's a question for the judge, and he's the only one that's going to decide that. So it's funny when you think about, well, how are juries going to think about this? It's like that. It's a strategy, right? You say, you ask a question this way, you try to lead a guy a certain way, and a judge is going to be smart enough to figure out what's going on. I've just been having fun with, again, another, I look for the fun in these things. The judge Alsup is apparently hysterical. I mean, he's just called it the World Series of IP cases. And he basically said anything that's embarrassing will be out in the public unless it's like a Coca-Cola recipe, that kind of thing. So if you have embarrassing things and you don't remember stuff, it's going to be public. So this is just going to take a long time to shake out. It looks like Google claims that how this actually works is that there's this Java runtime, this J2ME, this virtual machine, that isn't entirely open sourced. And if you're going to break compatibility, you need some kind of license to do that. And Google was saying, no, we didn't use your runtime. We made our own thing called Dalvik. And so it's kind of hard to say that they're completely separate, because one of the engineers that worked on the system for Google used to work at Sun with Java. So he could have unintentionally just copied something without even thinking about it. And that's not necessarily going to save you when it comes to, like, copying a technology if it's copyrighted. So that's a whole other issue. So I'm just kind of relatively swimming in these details right now. It's murky.
Yes. Well, hopefully the judge can sort it all out, and we'll continue to watch. But it definitely is, you know, the World Series of IP cases, and they've got, you know, not only the big guns at the companies, but the very big gun lawyers involved too. So it's kind of fun, you know, if you're in San Francisco and can get into the courtroom, it would certainly be worthwhile to take some of it in. Let's talk about ACTA, which is still out there kicking around. But the Europeans don't care for it much. It got dealt a pretty bad blow. The Europe's 27 member states could not pass the agreement there. So that's good news for folks who are not real wild about ACTA becoming the law of the land. Greg, were you surprised about this at all?
No. Nope. This law is you talk about marketing, this law is attached to the internet public. It just sees this as evil. Now they've softened it, they've watered it down. I don't have any hope for this law at all. This thing is as dead as SOPA.
Well, that's great news for everyone who's been following this on our show, I would think. Ayaz, do you think that there's any life left in ACTA?
I hope not. I mean, I like, the thing is that for some reason I have like a mental block when it comes to ACTA in the first place. Mm-hmm. So if I never have to remember what it is, I'd be happy about that.
Just hope it quietly goes away.
Yeah, because then I don't have to learn it.
That's right. Evan, what about you? Did you see that ACTA got knocked out in Europe?
Yeah, this is exciting, and if it indeed is true, because you know I wasn't up to date on you know precisely what the status is, but it you know having heard Greg say what he said about it, you know it sounds like there's some good sense, and if it were to you know go down in defeat in Europe as what it looks like it will, that's really an embarrassment for us over here in the U.S., isn't it? Even more so than what it was beforehand. If we, along with Canada and Japan and whoever else you know has signed on to it, it really is egg on our face to a certain extent in what we think of in terms of you know the importance of the civil liberties and the impingements thereupon that go from all this. So I'm happy to see what's happening on it.
Yeah, I think you've touched on an interesting bigger picture here too. There's a shift going on. Technology, there was a time when the entertainment companies had a huge profile. You had the influence of U.S. entertainment companies has gone all over the world, right? You go to Southeast Asia, you go to anywhere in the world, and you hear Elvis, and you see our movies, and it's huge. And we had some sway on some of the copyright laws that protected these industries, and now you see technology pushing them out of the way. I think I've said this so many times before, but I really think it was important. SOPA was a major shift. It kind of exemplified what's happening. Technology is muscling out the entertainment sector as far as influence. More people care about the internet and how it functions and the freedoms of the internet than they do care about their favorite TV shows.
Yeah, that is a huge shift. And Greg, do you see that that's actually starting to have some impact in Washington?
Absolutely. SOPA was some of those guys, I'd gone to some of the hearings that led up to SOPA. And some of those guys were making very strong speeches about the importance of protecting copyrighted materials, and they're making these declarations. And some of those same guys were running for the hills when technology sector flexed its muscles. They were shocked. They were surprised. Let's not forget how quickly and how dramatically the opposition to SOPA just got up and swept, sent those guys scattering every congressman and a lot of major companies. They were looking for cover. They were afraid. They had no idea this was coming. And, you know, there's a lot of people that are whispering on the copyright owner side in Hollywood and here in New York at the major labels that technology couldn't do that again. And my response has been, are you willing to bet another attempt, another major defeat on that belief? And I don't think they are. I don't think you'll see an honest-to-goodness attempt to get a SOPA-like piece of legislation anytime soon. Not this year. I'm making my bet. Not this year, you won't.
Good. Well, from your mouth to their ears, let's hope for the best. Let's talk too about Twitter. Twitter had an interesting announcement this week about what they're going to do with their patents. They are publishing a draft of something they call the Innovators Patent Agreement, a new way to do patent assignment that keeps control in the hands of Twitter and the employees. And they plan not to use patents from employees' inventions in offensive litigation without employees' permission. That doesn't seem like, you know, a great consensus, but just the fact that they're coming out and saying that they're going to use their patents defensively and not to go out and pursue people like Oracle is doing in its case, is a pretty big statement. Greg, do you see this as something substantive or more in the nature of PR?
I'll be skeptical and I'll say it was, you know, everybody values their own intellectual property, right? You work hard at coming up with ideas. You work hard at coming up with new technologies. And to come out for Twitter does the same thing. And to come out and say, hey, well, look, we're going to try to make peace. Let's give them the benefit of the doubt. If it is in their interest, or if they're trying to say, look, this is not going to get us anywhere, all these fights, and they're trying to tell people, we're not interested in making money this way, I think they should be applauded. But it also can't hurt to kind of say, hey, we're good guys. We're trying to be, you know, peacemakers. And they get a lot of PR hits out of that. I think it's in their benefit on both sides.
Well, this isn't retroactive or anything, is it? Like, I mean, they have patent. Twitter has patents on other things. I mean, one of the famous ones they have is the pull down and refresh. So, I mean, this IPA doesn't seem to cover that, does it?
I don't know. I mean, it doesn't really say whether they're going to pull back on any offensive stances that they've taken in the past. They're not real clear about that. So are they actually suing folks about that, IS?
Not yet, not yet. But that's just a monstrous one that's been used by so many different app developers that it does, I mean, it does have people nervous because I think, like, Gmail uses it, and I know Twitter does. There's a whole bunch of different applications that use it. And so if they're really going to stand by this kind of thing, assuming they get, I guess, the other thing is they said that we won't do this unless we get permission. I wonder how do you somehow get permission from the inventor? You go like, hey, you want to work here tomorrow? I would like you to somehow maybe allow us to use this offensively. It just seems like, I don't know how Twitter's corporate culture is. So that's the other thing. It's not like I've heard like really negative things about Zynga's corporate culture, and I could maybe believe that. But Twitter, I don't know how they are there. So maybe they are being good guys, but they're probably just seeing all the lawsuits in the news all the time. We're always seeing Samsung and Apple every 5 minutes. So they look like some great guys like, oh, yeah, tell you what, we're going to have an agreement. We're going to name it after a beer, and it's going to be good.
Right. IPA. Exactly. I don't know. I mean, I'm not a patent lawyer, but the thing about getting permission from the inventor, I think you have to do that in every instance, and that it's usually kind of a rubber stamp thing, as you say. So I don't see that as necessarily a big deal. Some of our patent lawyer friends can correct me if I'm wrong about that. But I do, I mean, it's nice to see a company coming out with a statement like this that tends to chill the ongoing patent wars, or at least ratchet down the level of hostility. So good for Twitter on that front. And we'll have to keep an eye on that and see what they do with it. And if other people, I sort of see this as something they're trying to spread. So we'll have to see if anyone else jumps on the bandwagon with them. Greg, we talked about the Department of Justice case about Apple, their ebook case, last week on the show. You published a piece that you thought that the DOJ is likely not to have any success there. You want to tell us why?
Well, it all boils down to this. Apple isn't responsible for the pricing, right? And we only said that they're not going to be responsible, or they're not going to likely be successful when it comes to Apple. Mm-hmm. Apple didn't do anything except suggest a new model. It was the publishers, the book publishers, that said, you know, let's get together and let's adopt this new agency model. Let me start again. There's two models, right, that are used in the book publishing industry. And one is the wholesale model, which allows the retailer to negotiate rights for a book and then sell that book for whatever they think they can get. And they can lower the price or raise the price however they want. But the agency model gives the pricing power, the retail price, to consumers, and it puts it in the hands of the publishers. What happened was Apple went to the publishers and said, hey, look, you guys are worried about Amazon. Amazon is coming in there and cutting prices, and Barnes & Noble and Sony and everybody else is having problems competing. Why don't you guys go to an agency model and you'll set the price, we'll get on board, and it'll force Amazon to adopt the same thing. You guys can pressure Amazon to adopt this model, and then they won't be able to cut prices anymore. Well, that sounds anti-competitive, right? But it's really up to the publishers to say, no, we can't do that because of, you know, we don't want to be anti-competitive. The publishers are on the hook. We don't see how a case, and lots of attorneys that we had talked to, experts in this, antitrust, said it's going to be really, really hard for the government to make a case against Apple.
Right, unless they can somehow show that Apple was right in there with the publishers, making right. this plan to fix prices.
Right, but based on the information they've released right now, that there's nothing that's obvious that says that Apple had, you know, a hand in setting the price.
All right. Well, that one is rolling along as well. And I'm sure Apple likes the way that you've concluded. Ayaz, any thoughts about this one?
Well, yeah, I mean, it sounds like with I read the article Greg wrote, and it just sounds like basically Apple's like the little devil on the shoulder. They're just saying like, hey, got this idea.
That's a great way to...
And they're like, we should just all agree to meet in a room. Like, that's the other silly thing. They actually, all the publishing heads are like literally meeting physically. That's even crazier to have an agreement. It's like, do you ever like watch any television shows or movies? You don't do that. It just seems really silly. So I think Apple's in the clear, but these publishers and a bunch of them obviously settled with the DOJ thinking like, look, we're probably in trouble. So I'm kind of curious about the two or three publishers that haven't settled with the DOJ. I'm really curious about what they're going to argue, because Apple, they're like, look, we don't publish books. We don't set prices. We just gave an idea. We're allowed to do that. So I just want to see how the rest of the publishing industry shakes out.
All right. Well, let's talk. We've been talking a lot on this episode about liability for folks who are hosting other people's content. And, of course, Pinterest is something we've talked about a lot in the past and is on people's minds. Of course, if you haven't noticed, Pinterest is not just for photos and web stories that you might see around and that you decide to pin. It's also got a video section. And, of course, they would be facing the same kinds of concerns as we've been talking about with respect to YouTube, et cetera, if they're hosting or pointing to. See, there is a difference in the way that Pinterest is architected. Whereas they'll actually copy and host the photos, they're not doing that with videos. They might embed or point to other videos. So the question becomes, well, then could they or their users be liable for that activity? Which is kind of a big question. Not too long ago, there was an amicus brief filed by the entertainment industry arguing that embedded videos should be considered infringing if they are indeed using copyrighted material, that the person who does the embedding should be considered a direct infringer, which is kind of a big and outrageous statement to make given the laws that are out there and the decisions that have come down saying that, you know, linking and embedding is protected. So once again, Pinterest finds itself in the middle of an interesting legal conundrum. Ayaz, have you thought about this at all?
Yeah, we talked about this on Twit, I think, last week. And the weird thing is I'm having trouble with, like, this reminds me of when Google News was scraping content and they and the AFP and the AP got really mad about this. They're like, look, you're stealing our content. You're stealing our stuff. And they settled out of court. And the thing is, I don't know what it's blogging, right? Like, if you embed a video, this is how the internet's been working for a very long time. We can link to stuff, we can embed stuff. And why is it different with Pinterest? I'm not really quite sure. I mean, you can have a blog and you can do this, but the fact that you have a link now is this, I guess, because it's a popular service, right? And the thing is, if they're making money, maybe there's someone to go after, but you're still going to go after the person who's really hosting it, or the company. That's usually YouTube or Facebook or somebody like that who's hosting the content. But I don't get why there would be all this hubbub about Pinterest with this when they aren't actually hosting anything.
Right. I do think that you've got it right, that it's just a matter of being in the public eye and a big target, you know, if they feel like they can go after Pinterest and its users, that will be either lucrative or high profile or both. What do you think, Greg?
Well, I think this is the same story we've been looking at forever, right? There's got to be some kind of tech solution to this problem, because asking copyright owners to send these takedown notices, it just seems like a untenable long-term solution. So we've got to come up, in my opinion, that there's got to be a way for people who don't mind their materials and their intellectual property to kind of automatically allow it to go up And then for those people who do not, you know, for it to be filtered and people to be educated about it, because I believe a lot of this information and a lot of the problem, people just don't know. They see an image they like and they just post it, and they don't know about copyright law, the intricacies of what they're allowed to do or not do. So I'm looking for some of the, you know, techies to come up with a solution for this. There's definitely a market for it.
I mean, YouTube kind of solved this kind of issue, right? They were talking about, oh, you're using our music underneath as a music bed. Well, we'll just put YouTube's like, we'll just put a link where you can buy the song right there, and we'll license it for you. I mean, I don't think Pinterest is going to go out of their way to license any of this stuff. But, I mean, if the, again, the hosts are taking care of it, isn't that already the solution? Because, I mean, YouTube's taking care of it, and they're making deals. And if you're embedding, let's say you're embedding a Hulu video or something, like, there are already deals in place there. I guess it's if you're, I could see there being a real issue if you have one, like a pin board, and all you do is you find like television shows on YouTube that are illegally there, and you know they're illegal. I mean, like, again, you have to show some kind of like bad act for there to be some kind of, you don't have to show that, but it would, it seems like that would be the real case where there's an issue, because why would any of these companies go after some small guy on Pinterest? It's like, oh yeah, I have this one page. I mean, it's happened in the UK. I know this guy was that TV Links site. He got extradited because he had links to stuff he didn't host. Which I still find confusing, how they were able to get him over here.
Right. That seems like the case that proves the problematic issue of link or embedding liability. But, you know, I think that might have been a fluke that, you know, in front of another court on another day, he would still be sitting there and not extradited.
Yeah, I think linking shouldn't be a crime.
Yeah.
Or embedding is not a crime.
Free the linkers. All right, well, let's get to our resource and tip of the week. Our resource is only sort of tangentially related to technology and or law, but of course, law involves a whole lot of education, and certainly if you're interested in the kinds of things that we talk about on the show and would like to learn more about them, I encourage you to check out and keep an eye on Coursera. At Coursera.org. It's been written about quite a bit lately, and there's a big New York Times article about it. There's an article in Wired about someone who went through a Coursera course at Stanford. And what it is basically a platform for professors to be able to offer university curriculum classes to people who are not at the university. And Princeton and Stanford and the University of Michigan, University of Pennsylvania, I think MIT is doing something similar, but maybe not part of this program. You can go and take courses in math and statistics, computer science, humanities and social sciences, healthcare, medicine and biology, economics, finance and business, society, networks and information. And they're the same things as you would get at these great universities. You don't wind up getting a degree in the subject, but you get a certificate of completion that you took the course. And it may be that you don't need a degree in that subject. You just need the knowledge in the class. And the New York Times piece talks about how this came in very practically important and handy for folks working in Japan on the nuclear crisis there, and has been useful on any other number of fronts. So Coursera, it's got great funding and great folks behind it. Looks like something to watch. And then our tip of the week is for folks who are engaged in offering up terms of service, something we talk about a lot on the show, the right way and wrong way to do them. 500px has taken a very interesting approach to their terms of service. They have, you know, a pretty standard terms of service on their site with a lot of legalese and big long clauses of stuff that you'd probably never read. But what they've done is they've taken the big long clauses, and for each one, now you can see it on screen if you're watching the video, they have distilled it down to one sentence that basically captures in plain English what that clause means. For example, the very first clause, acceptance of terms, by using 500px, you agree to all the terms below, is what three paragraphs of text essentially boils down to. And they do that through all of their terms, including user conduct and It just makes it very reader and user friendly and easier to understand. Now, I throw this out there with a grain of salt. This came up on the Project VRM mailing list with Doc Searle's project at Harvard. And Doc weighed in on this and said, you know, this is all well and good, and it's great to make terms more readable, but all this really does is just make it more apparent how awful these terms of service really are and how one-sided they are. And, you know, if that's what you want to do, then go ahead. But the better thing might be to actually get to the heart of the terms and make it more of a reciprocal and conscionable kind of arrangement. But, you know, in the world that we live in, it's certainly better to have things be comprehensible than not. So 500px's terms of service is our tip of the week for folks looking to examples and ideas for how to put these things together. Any thoughts on our resources, guys? Greg?
They sound great. I mean, I don't know. Forgive me. I was reading the internet, so they sounded interested.
Yeah, I know how that goes.
Yes, exactly. Hey, Evan, we blew through the Pinterest story. I wanted to circle back to you since you were quoted in the piece in our discussion links on video on Pinterest. Do you want to weigh in on that one real quick?
I'm sure that you guys evaluated it in every way that it's to be evaluated. But if anything, it just the way that the Pinterest does not host the video itself kind of underscores the difference in Pinterest services in the way that it could run greater risk of liability because it actually does host infringing static images. The fact that it just embeds or you know hot links to images, you know that distinction really underscores the nature of the risk that it faces. So don't know if I said anything to add to the discussion with that, but I thought it was interesting that Grant Crowell, who wrote that article, was kind of taking the angle of looking at video and looking at video on Pinterest and evaluating what the differences in the legal questions might be.
Right. Do you think that there's any foot to stand on for, you know, suppose I toss this out as an example. Mm-hmm. Suppose you have someone who is using Pinterest in its curating function, you know, as lots of people do, and combing through YouTube and finding examples of things that YouTube's filtering system has not pulled down, links to things that are clearly infringing, not supposed to be up there, but are there nonetheless, and maybe their shelf life will be short. But then using Pinterest to aggregate those things and have a you know, central repository, if you will, for all the videos of something like Lost or some, you know, certainly Hollywood not supposed to be on YouTube kind of experience. Do you think that that person or Pinterest might have a problem, even though all they're doing is linking through?
Well, I think the question of liability for the individual user is different than it would be for Pinterest. You know, the scenario that you're bringing up, which is what Ayaz brought up, sounds a lot like the scenario with Google Images and Perfect 10. The allegations there were that, you know, the images that Perfect 10 is copyright owner, its images were being served up by Google, and these were infringements. And Google, you know, was not responsible for that, the court held, because it wasn't serving them up. It was just providing that link like that. So the same would appear to be there with Pinterest. I don't know if the question of liability for the end user would be any different in as much as they're serving more of a curatorial function, because it really is at the direction of them that is, it's really at their direction that all of this stuff is being put together. So that would seem to give credence to a case of direct infringement against the user. But I don't think that would change the analysis for Pinterest, because all it's doing is providing the platform here, and it's what's really relevant is its volition, you know, the volitional act. If we go back to the Netcom case all the way back in 1995, it's so important to look at what the will of the intermediary, the platform, is here, and I just don't see it changing in any meaningful way that would put liability on its part. So I think Pinterest is just fine. I'm not all that worried about its liability.
All right. Well, that's good to know. And it's been great chatting with you guys. It's been a really fun episode of the show. We covered a lot of ground, and it's great to have Greg back with us. Have a great time following all the trials that you like to attend and write about, Greg. What should we look for coming up soon? What's set for an interesting hearing?
Oh, well, there's a lot of good stuff coming. MP3 tunes versus EMI. There's going to be oral arguments next month. We've got more mega upload in New Zealand. There's going to be an extradition hearing in August. So, for YouTube and Viacom, we have to wait for the next chapter in that. So there's a lot of stuff coming.
Great. Well, have fun covering it all. We'll follow you over at CNET and hopefully get you back on the show soon.
Thank you.
Take care. Hey, Ayaz, love having you on the show from the studio. Thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks thanks for having me on. It's always an educational experience for me because this getting to this degree of intricacy is something I avoid like the plague. But I enjoy actually learning this stuff and going through it again because it kind of gets the gears going again. But thank you so much.
We appreciate you overcoming your natural disinclination and joining us today. It's been great.
Thank you. And we'll have Denise on TNT later today if you're watching this live. If you're listening to this recorded, you can just download that episode at twit.tv/TNT.
That's right. And Evan, it's great to see you after a couple of weeks away from you.
Yes, it's great to be back. I've enjoyed the conversation, and thanks for your patience with me today while I had to bow out for a little while. It's been, really exciting afternoon and really have enjoyed our conversation. So, Greg, Ayaz, great to talk with you as well.
Thank you.
You too, Evan.
Right
All
on.
Right. So, folks, if you're listening live, we very much appreciate you doing that. We record the show every Friday at 11 o'clock Pacific Time, 1800 UTC at twit.tv. If you're listening after the fact, it's always fun to have you join us live and watch the video as well. If you are looking to consume the show on a more time-delayed basis, we're available on YouTube and iTunes and all the other likely spots where you might look for good podcast and videocast content. And we've got a couple of pages where you can connect with us between the shows. Twill has a page on Facebook and also on Google Plus. I'm on Twitter. You can always at me there. I'm D Howell there. And you can shoot me an email. Please do between the shows, Denise at twit.tv. Let us know what's on your mind, what interesting legal stories you have stumbled on that you would love to see us talk about in more detail. So we'll look forward to hearing from you all and to our next episode of This Week in Law next week, Friday at 11 o'clock. Take care, everyone.